Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Peace in a Pod. I'm your host Keshav, and today we have a very interesting episode for you. On this episode, we talk about third-party mediation in the public sector, private sector, and in international organizations. Third-party mediation is a fairly simple concept wherein an external, neutral mediator is appointed mutually by disputing parties. The idea here is that a third party will help the disputing parties settle the conflict between them. Through this process, they attempt to find common ground and options for peaceable settlement. Now, these two disputing parties can be family members, organizations, businesses, or even national governments. The process is not legally binding, so the parties can walk away whenever they want at any stage. On a daily basis across the world, mediations occur in different forms, in different forums. Today, we speak to an expert in the field of third-party mediation, Mr. Giuseppe De Palo. He has worked both in the private sector and in IOs. Today, he helps prevent and resolve work disputes within a variety of UN bodies like the UNDP, UNICEF, UNFPA, UNOPS, and UN Women. His understanding in this field is unparalleled, and you'll notice that through the course of our conversation. By the end of this episode, we hope you have a better understanding of third-party mediation in conflict resolution and perhaps be open to the idea of mediation yourself. Here's Giuseppe. Mr. De Palo, it is such a pleasure to have you on Peace in a Pod.
Thank you very much, Keshav, for having me.
We've been talking about mediation a little bit, and just to understand mediation as a concept and look at mediation as a career for many of our listeners, can you just talk us through your career and in a practical sense, how do you go about mediating conflict?
Well, thank you so much, Keshav. This year, like 15 days into 2021, marks my passing the 25th anniversary into mediation. So a question like that is, of course, an invite to talk about, to reflect. So I welcome that question very much. First of all, for those who are less familiar with the term, very often we realize people think that mediation is meditation. It's an old joke, but, you know, it's still some basis. It is essentially the intervention of a third-party neutral to facilitate dialogue, particularly when there is a dispute, there is an argument, a disagreement that the two or more litigants have not been able to resolve by themselves. So that is essentially what it is. And it can happen in a social context, in the legal context, in the tribunal, within a family, or within an organization. Any kind of disagreement. And humankind is bound to disagree. We social animals stick together for protection, for growth, for passion, for lots of evolutionary reasons, but we are at the same time bound to disagree. And the idea is that the way we as animals, just as humans, we react to challenges, to fear, to confrontation, is essentially twofold. Primarily, the primary instinct in the face of a disagreement and especially of a conflict is either to do nothing about it, hope to walk away, well, hope that the conflict will abate, and if it doesn't, be ready to stand down, or at the very opposite side of this ideal spectrum, people would fight, you know, people call it fight or flight. Mediation, in addition to a negotiation and to the judicial processes, is a civilized in-between way of these two extremes, doing nothing and taking justice into your own hands, to resolve those disagreements, to first actually get a better understanding of what the problem is and move on. That is a pretty generic, pretty wide, I would say, definition of the mediation process. There are so many in the literature, but I think everybody agrees on this elements of being a facilitated process, where most importantly, nobody make decisions for the parties, for the two litigants. I say two litigants, could be more. It could be a village against a developer or an environmental group against the government. It could be anything when there is a confrontation or a disagreement, even more broadly. Disagreement does not yet mean confrontation, of course. And somebody steps in, accepted by both parties, to be the facilitator. You know, if we think about our own families, right, our large families, we might easily identify somebody who has, you know, more than others play that role when there is a discussion or a decision to be made within the family and there are different opinions. Why a career out of that? That's an interesting question, Keshav, I was speaking about. And one of those questions that you ask more of yourself when you get older. I think that it's a long story. As I said, I'll cut it short. When I went to law school, I started in 1987. I believe one of the drivers was the idea that I would want to know what are the rules that prevent or can allow you to manage in a civilized, formal, respectful way conflict. So I suspect that deep down, I'm not sure if this is true for all people enrolling in law school, that I had a dislike for conflict. And the idea of having a formalized, predictable, written down system would relieve me of the anxiety of what to do in the face of conflict. And I can tell you that the first year, especially the first two, but especially the first one of law school was joyful. Everything was clear. The manuals and the code would provide a solution for every possible problem. So I was really in love with that. I stayed in love in my third year in the law school, but then I realized that virtually anything could be argued. So as you progress in law school, you start tackle very difficult issues. Some people would call it intractable conflict. And you could really see that the sides' positions, the arguments of both sides have some merit. And then is when I think I started having the realization that the trial system where somebody listens to both sides, witnesses, looks at evidence and makes a decision, could be very simplistic. Both the process that the parties have to go through, and in terms of the outcome, you can win, you know, a lot of money in the court, but you might not get an apology from the other side. You might not get a sense that the person is felt bad about what happened, and especially when what affected the victim, what we would call the plaintiff, the person seeking redress in court, when that person was touching something which is not monetary, it's value. You know, family member was injured or killed, or somebody was publicly humiliated, there's really no amount of money that can make up for that, which is, you know, big tardy realization when you get into your fourth year of law school and you gear up for being a protagonist of that, you know, adversarial system. So the big swift change for me was to, when I came for my master's to the United States of America. And I, to my surprise, things have changed now, but the legal education system here, where I'm now currently sitting in New York City, included a lot of skills-based courses. I remember interviewing, counseling, and negotiating. So that is where it started. And I promise I would make this short. I'm not maybe delivering on that. But the big event was that at the very end of my mediation class, I went to shadow an actual mediation in what is, I think, even today, one of the most prominent mediation centers in the world. That was the office of JAMS in San Francisco. And I really, you know, followed in the shadow like a fly on a wall, this mediator who was dealing with a real case, you know, from start to finish, from 8 o'clock in the morning until 7 p.m. in the afternoon. And I saw mediation in action. And I think that's when I really saw the light. Some people said I saw too much of it because I felt enamored with the process. And when I, after a few years of practicing law, traditional law in the city of Brussels in Belgium, I was doing European competition law, but my heart was beating for mediation. I decided to quit my law practice. And in 1988, I established Italy's first commercial mediation services, ADR Center, which is still functioning. 5 years ago, I left the company and any role in it in order to join the United Nations as the ombudsman for the funds and programs, which is the main humanitarian agencies. And I became, as the ombudsman, the, among other things, the internal mediator for disputes within the organizations, with the five organizations. Could be a dispute between an employee and the employer, between two employees, or even, you know, when there are issues between the organizations themselves.
Thank you so much. That was very informative, and you were very concise, despite what you said. So just jumping into mediation in and of itself, because a lot of people, they understand mediation because they probably do it in their own lives, for their families, for in their workplace, things like that. But according to somebody who's worked in the field for so many years, what role of mediation do you see in resolving conflicts, and how does that work?
Keshav, it's an excellent question. You know, if you think about it, the very need to define mediation, you know, for a society as evolved, you know, as ours, it's kind of paradoxical. You would not think, for example, that you would have to explain litigation to anybody, right? Whether they are initiated into the field or not. Also, mediation is clearly, to me, older than, for example, arbitration, the judicial process, at least in the formalized ways we have got to know these two processes, arbitration and litigation. So what I like to say about it, and it's not my analogy, but a lot of people, when I started, a lot of people refer to mediation as the sleeping beauty. I mean, isn't it obvious that if there is a disagreement that two people cannot deal with by themselves peacefully, amicably, economically, would resort to the facilitation of a wise person? Doesn't have to be old, as somebody who can help facilitate, to prevent escalation, to contain the cost, to limit the time so that people can move on, right? At the end of the day, in fact, most of our conflicts and disagreements are resolved this way. Yes, we have millions of cases in court, but in our daily lives, we go through disagreements, you know, conclude negotiations and find the solutions to challenges informally, amicably. So why not to use a device, mediation, that would facilitate that, would make it more professional, quicker, reliable? The literature here is enormous, and I always like to mention that the first time that the Nobel Prize in Economics was not given to economists, one was I believe, in 2002, when Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, two psychologists, explain how we tend to do irrational choices in the face of uncertainty. And the most typical uncertain situation is if I have a dispute, right? Because I have two options normally. One, I can go on with the dispute, for example, going to a judge, right, and wait for his or her decision. Or I can settle the dispute now somehow. Surveys that are being done have shown that the number of mediated cases is a minuscule fraction of the litigated ones. A European Parliament report a few years back estimated that it was about around 1%. So in 99% of the cases, we choose rationally, we choose a process which is lengthier, more cumbersome, more expensive, and most importantly, unpredictable, because you never know the answer. To your question, I believe that the role of mediation could be much greater, certainly more than 1%. You should not be restricted to formal legal disputes, because the last thing I would say before turning over to you, somebody mentioned conflict is a growth industry. So conflict will grow, especially if the population continues to grow and the resources continue to become more scarce. So negotiation, mediation, amicable dispute resolution will become more and more important as we go ahead.
Just to follow up on something that you mentioned, mediation essentially would assume that the parties that are involved in the mediation process are, to a certain extent, rational, and they understand their best interests, want an outcome-oriented approach. But you also mentioned intractable conflicts. Like, isn't this the whole premise of mediation based on fundamental rationality of both the actors?
Yeah, it's another interesting question, Keshav, and I thank you for that. Let me take a long road to get there, but I'll start with the response, maybe counterintuitive. I believe that the value of rationality, the value of mediation, can be found in the opposite. That is, people are not provenly rational in how they deal with disputes. Therefore, for example, policies that encourage strongly or even oblige parties, litigants, to consider the mediation option seriously and even might provide sanctions, negative consequences for not engaging in the process are warranted. If we were rational, possibly we would not use litigation systems that often. Think about it. We do not know, I think nobody knows, nobody has the exact number, but with 7 billion of people around, I think we could easily say that several hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, might be entangled in some sort of a formal dispute, right? The only thing we know about this hundreds of millions of conflicts today, the formal justice system make only 50% at best of its users happy. I would say that to the extent people see that mediation has value, they might not be mediators, but they understand the need of a process which is simple, which is dialogical, which is human, which is cheap, which is not adversarial, makes sense. And they struggle to realize why there aren't that many mediators or that many mediations every year. You can see mediation being prominent as a social phenomenon in very different legal and national cultures. The common theme is not geographic or ethnic. The common theme is what is the legislative framework. You know, you cannot find lots of mediations without a proper legal framework. So at the different level of self-evidence of the statement, nothing else has worked. In every part of the world where, for example, tons of money was invested in promotion, in awareness, I was involved many years ago before joining the United Nations in the efforts by international organizations to support development mediation through the funding of mediation centers, right? And we would go to a normally developing country and we would physically build a center. We would have money to hire a company, create a structure, hire the personnel, and of course the service would be offered for free. And when that was available, people started using it. But when it came to pay even a dollar for the service and the money ran out, mediation went away. So there is the role of us as human beings as we process information and make decisions, and there is a role of the legal framework in which we operate that has to favor certain behavior, just like the same system disfavors other behavior. Smoking, for example, is really a question of governing properly and channeling our behavior for the individual and societal benefit. If we have more cases in mediation, maybe there would be less violence, right? So there is societal group value, but there is also an individual value.
In many ways, the benefit of litigation is that it is binding to at least one party's benefit, but it's still binding. But mediation by its very nature is voluntary. So do you think that is one of the reasons why national governments or people are not very willing to invest in the legal framework that is required to sustain mediation?
Terrific. And let me say, I'm sorry, you mentioned the binding, non-binding dichotomy before, and I kind of skipped on that. Well, mediation becomes binding when there is an agreement. And some people argue that because the parties decided to bind themselves, that is even more binding than having a court judgment. Because if you can escape a court judgment that is binding, you will do what you can. For example, against a judgment by the court of first instance, you typically have an appeal before an appeal court. And typically you have an appeal against a decision of an appeal court before a Supreme Court or court of cassation, as they're called. So the idea is if the parties agree at some point, the dispute is over. Also, most legal systems would recognize that the binding nature of that agreement of you and I, for example, to settle a dispute would be recognized by the legal system. It's a common feature of mediation legal system to provide for enforceability. One of the big success, highly celebrated, for example, the United Nations and especially UNCITRAL, the Commission for International Trade Law, which is based in Vienna, has been last year, the Singapore Convention, that has made it sure that if you and I reach an agreement between, say, you're in India and I'm in Italy, provided our two countries, India and Italy, become signatories to that convention, that agreement that we reach will be recognized in your country and mine. So if I change my mind after having agreed with you, I will not be able to get away with that. So there is a legal framework for that. I would say to the contrary that the non-binding nature could be an incentive to engage in it, because mediation becomes binding at the end of the process, that is, if you and I agree. If you and I disagree, there is no negative consequences. We try to talk, but there is no signature at the bottom on a dotted line at the end of a mediated agreement, which makes me more comfortable to engage in the process because I know I can walk away. The more important question where government struggles is to make that initial step, you know, free or not. And I've been arguing most of my entire life, that to the extent we will leave that decision entirely up to the parties, mediation will not just be sleeping, but will remain comatose, like it is in most countries where it's really up to the parties to decide whether to mediate or not. People say mediation is essentially voluntary. Why would you coerce people to do something? Well, it's never black and white. We're not coercing people to settle. That would be illogical, illegal in every part of the world. But you can ask people to make a serious attempt to do things.
In that case, would you say that mediation is, let's say, the natural first step for resolution of conflicts? Like, is it just a stepping stone in resolving conflicts, or is it a means to an end itself?
It's a pretty good question. No, it's really, I like this idea of the natural first step. I'd like to say that with others, I've been one of the champions of this notion. And it should not necessarily be, it's certainly not it's a means, it's not a goal. In fact, if you look at the best piece of legislation I know of, the goal is settlement, in facilitated settlement. And if settlement takes place without a mediator, that's absolutely fine, right? The question is, there is evidence and science about the idea that you and I, if we're dealing with our disputes face-to-face, we're going to lose some benefits of having a third-party intervention, somebody who can calm us down, somebody who can give us a different perspective. Somebody can de-bias you and me. You know, the whole behavioral economics is predicated upon this rational biases. They are called heuristics, you know, ways we make decisions that are not optimal. If somebody can make me aware of that bias, I can make a better decision. The reason why it should be an effort first step is because at the end of the day, it's an individual, I believe, and societal benefit in most cases. And that's very important, right? If I have, Keshav, one dispute only in my entire life, and if I am forced to try mediation, not to settle, now let's be clear, to try mediation, and mediation fails, I could say, what a waste of time, right? To resolve my issues, I had first to go through this mediation thing that didn't work, and then, of course, I had to go to court. Why couldn't I go directly to court? I would have saved myself one process. I have one dispute. They force me to go through mediation. I say no thanks. And then I have to start litigation to get the case resolved. My own case in society, in a political context, like a nation, a state, is not as relevant as the general interest in that. So what I always said is, you got to take all your horses to the water. I mean, all disputes should go to the water, which is mediation. Then what you do, you count how many horses drink. That's a plus. That's the savings. How many horses do not drink? And then you do the math. If the general number is that as a system, the use of mediation by everyone, or at least in most cases, I wouldn't say that every single case, is to be mediated, but in the majority of cases is positive, then the system gains. And keeping one thing in mind, the cost of doing or not doing a mediation is normally very limited. It might take a few days, it might cost some money, but it's a fraction of what it costs to litigate. So even if you have to do mediation and that is unsuccessful, and then you go to trial, the incremental cost of the mediation as pre-litigation step is minimum. So every single mediation successful accounts for many, many mediation fails. We call it a number of years ago, the break-even point. That is, what is the minimum success rate of mediation that you have in a system so that the aggregate costs of failed mediations is offset by the aggregate savings of successful ones? And I can tell you that number was about 20%. So as long as you have a meager 20% success rate, the system would gain. My day in court is not something that I pay 100% of, then I cannot claim that I'm entitled to have that. The 80% who are subsidizing my day in court, I believe, have a right to say, yes, you will have your day in court, sir or madam. But before you do that, I want you to try that.
Thank you so much, Mr. DiPaolo, not just for your very incisive comments, but also for your time and for talking to us at Peace in the Pod.
Well, thank you. I'm the one to be thankful to you and to your audience. Glad to be part of Peace in the Pod.
And that is it for this episode of Peace in the Pod. Thank you so much for joining us, as always. A special thanks to Alessandro Marinaro, who is part of the Peacebuilding Initiative, for connecting us with Giuseppe and introducing us to his work. Goodbye and see you next time.